RadioGorgeous.com, where you'll only hear the female voice. So, author of the week is Anne Seba, talking about Laura Ashley, A Life in Design. Did you know that the famous photograph of Princess Diana with the see-through skirt, have you ever seen that? Mm-mm. When she got engaged, it was terrible. The photographers kind of went to this, this school where she was working, this kind of nursery school, and they said, Diana, let's take some photos. And they suddenly realised the sun was behind her and you could see all her legs, you know, and sort of
the shape. And she was such a modest, shy.
I know, and it was so mean. And so all these photographers, chat, the next day. But the scandal was, it was a Laura Ashley skirt. So it made them really fashionable. And the thing is about Laura Ashley is we all have such a bad kind of image of it now. What do you think of when I say the word Laura Ashley?
It was at the same time as guinea sacks. Do you remember that? I mean, there was this phrase, you know, like big floral ruffles.
Yeah.
And stuffy, you know, to me, it's just stuffy, faux Victorian, you know. And also, none of those things, if you have a curvy figure like mine,
yeah,
that stuff looks like garbage.
Yeah, because it hangs off your bosom, so it makes you look even bigger.
It's like wearing a giant, you know, sheet. It's like I'm wearing a bed sheet.
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing for me there.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Okay. Well, just to say that when she started out, though, her whole vision, because now it's a massive conglomerate owned by Malaysians, then it was invented at her kitchen table, and she is a pure visionary and an artist, and that's what's really interesting. And also she did it totally as a partnership with Bernard, her husband. So it's like Laura Ashley was a name, but together they were an ultra dynamic couple. Let's listen to it now. Welcome back to Radio Gorgeous, the biographer and lecturer Anne Seba. We're here to talk about Laura as you wrote the official biography of Laura Ashley. Hello, Anne. So Laura really never set out to be an artist.
I think what Laura and Bernard wanted to do, don't forget, the marriage was absolutely crucial. Neither would have been anything without the other. And they both wanted to do something different. They grew up in suburban Surrey, Carshalton, although she made great play of the fact that she was Welsh. She just happened to have been born in Wales. She did have Welsh background, Welsh stock. But actually, they were suburban Surrey, a young couple who just wanted to break free. They knew after the war they could do something different. I think the key was that Laura joined the Wrens and went to France. Bernard joined the Gurkhas and went abroad. This gave them an opening into a new world. So they came back, and instead of settling in suburban Surrey, they settled in Pimlico. You know, all of that was trying to break free. So I don't know that they necessarily set out to be a designer. Bernard actually thought he was going to be the next Ernest Hemingway. He fancied himself as writing books. And he said to Laura, look, you've got to do something else. You've got to do something to support me. So she started out as a secretary in the WI, the Women's Institute. And when she went to the Women's Institute, they had a great display, a show at the Albert Hall, and she saw these patchwork quilts. And she did a little bit of sewing, and she thought, well, you can't make patchwork quilts without tiny little prints. Where can I go and buy tiny little prints? And when she researched that, she found that they didn't exist. So that was one of the nuggets, the seeds that started them off. There were several others. They were married in 1949, and they had their holiday, which was really revolutionary for a young couple in those days. They had a holiday in Italy. And in Rome, they saw Audrey Hepburn type girls. Audrey Hepburn had just made her name in Roman holiday with Gregory Peck. And she was wearing these little polka dot scarves. They called them sweater scarves. They were tiny. And lots of the girls on motorbikes in Rome were wearing these sweater scarves. And they came back from that holiday and they thought, maybe we can print these scarves. So that was another little starting point for them both. Now, they didn't know how to print. They were the original autodidacts. They taught themselves everything. Bernard had a job in the city, which he absolutely hated, just to pay the bills. But he went to the library after work and he learned how to print. Now, they could only do terribly simple basic printing on the kitchen table. So when people say it was a rags to riches story from the kitchen table, it really was. He covered the kitchen table with a sort of felt blanket, put a plastic cover on top of that. He constructed a silk screen, but it was constructed of wood. So the wood often warps. I mean, the best silk screens are made of metal. And everything had to be the size of this silk screen. So we're talking small here. So a scarf was perfect. They didn't know how to draw. That's why, you know, they weren't really designers. All they could draw were simple things like polka dots or noughts and crosses, just like you might do potato cuts with your child. And that was what they started out doing. They made these little scarves, and then the other things they could do were table mats and napkins. And what happened was Laura decided she'd go and visit the buyer in Peter Jones. That was the big department store then with little boutiques. And she hadn't made an appointment, and she went with a few samples. And that was it. In 1953, the buyer of Peter Jones really liked them and asked Laura to repeat the order. So they stayed up all night printing, hand hemming. They had a few friends. I've met some of their friends who got roped in to do the hand hemming so that Laura could take a repeat order. And then she was away. And that's really how it started at the kitchen table, a chapter of accidents. And they moved on from there.
That's amazing. Yes, her designs, they went on to tea towels as well, and she started looking at different patterns, didn't she? She was always researching, wasn't she, to get ideas?
Yes, I think in another world, Laura would have been an academic. She really loved the researching. She went to the Victoria and Albert Museum, she went to antique shops, and she found these tiny little prints that she could copy. So that was part of her inspiration. Bernard, quite the reverse. I mean, it was really funny. He never thought this was going to be their life's work. If he was going to be a printer, he wanted to print big, jazzy fabrics that he could sell by, you know, roll after roll for cruise liners, for P&O. That was his aim. If he couldn't be a writer, if he couldn't be the next Ernest Hemingway, so he'd print all these great jazzy fabrics. He was terribly jealous of Terence Conran. So that was one of the things that drove him on. He thought, well, if Terence Conran can do it, I can do it bigger and better. So he hired a London showroom in Old Burlington Street for his great big jazzy prints. And Laura all the time thought, actually, I quite like these little Victorian prints. They'll do for the patchworks, or they'll do for the little table mats and the napkins. And Bernard, because he never thought these were going to last, he was really rude about table mats and tea towels, because he thought, you know, only women do the washing up. Washing up isn't a man's thing. So he thought, okay, if Laura's going to put her name on it, Laura Ashley can be the signature on these, because they're silly little things that women do. Once I get my hands on the big jazzy fabrics, it'll say Bernard Ashley. But it never got that far. And he had to be the salesman. So he would visit all these country craft shops and kitchen shops all around the country. He hated it. He hated being a travelling salesman, selling these rather silly, as he thought, little domestic products that were defined by the width of the silk screen that he'd constructed. But they depended on that for orders. And he told me when I interviewed him, because I only started writing my book after Laura died. Yeah. She died in 1985. So I only had Bernard to tell me. And he used to say if these country shops didn't take a big enough order, he'd go in munching an apple. And if they didn't place a big order, he'd put the apple core in the basket on the way out to show his displeasure. Because he kept waiting for the big break, you know, when he could sell his big jazzy fabrics. Well, it never happened, because the little small Victorian prints became so popular that he made the best of what they had. But it wasn't what he intended to do, a chapter of accidents.
So they had children. Then she went through quite a kind of hippie-ish period, didn't she?
Actually, both of them were a little bit anti-establishment at the beginning. And then, of course, when they had pots of money and they lived grandly, they embraced the establishment and they became tax exiles and lived in castles. But yes, you're right to call it a hippie phase. I've never really called it that. They moved out to the country once they had children. They eventually had four. But when they had three, the fourth child was born in Wales. When they had three, they moved to the Surrey countryside, Limpsfield. And life was really tough there. They had a sort of subsistence life, living off what they could grow, their own vegetables. They were so poor that often the phone was cut off and the council was told about that. The children drank out of jam jars, didn't have shoes. I mean, they really were quite poor, because every extra bit of money was being ploughed back into the business. And Bernard kept trying to get a loan. And this was the period when he began his hatred of what he called the suits, because he could never get a big enough loan. And it was at this time that the printing works flooded. And although they got insurance money back, they really wondered, what's the point? It's so difficult to make a living. And I think life was so tough that the marriage suffered. And the marriage reached a pretty low point in around 1960, that Laura just packed up the children in the Morris Minor and decided she was going to walk out. And if Bernard followed, fine. And she knew he would, but I think she was prepared to make a break on her own. And she went back to Wales, which is quite interesting. It wasn't the Wales of her childhood. It wasn't industrial South Wales. It was mid Wales. And she ended up on a campsite with the three children. And of course, in 3 weeks later, Bernard did follow. The real battle was whether they were going to go retail or stay wholesale. Eventually, of course, Laura Ashley became this extraordinary vertically integrated shop where they bought the cotton, printed it, manufactured it, designed it, made the clothes, and had their own shop. So an extraordinary vertically integrated company. But in those days, Bernard kept saying, I don't want a shop, because for him, having a shop was going backwards. Yeah. He'd been born above the shop in Catford. Mm-hmm. The last thing in the world he wanted was to go back to a retail outlet. But because he'd followed Laura up, that's why she was so clever. She was able to manipulate him. She knew he would follow. And eventually they bought a little flat above a shop in a historic town called Mahuntleth in Wales. And at that point, they started selling Welsh products, lifestyle products, sort of the Welsh flannel nightdress, but a little bit of Welsh honey as well, or Welsh walking sticks. So she had understood intuitively that actually by selling clothes, you could sell a little bit of the countryside too. And that's how it started, with this flat above the shop in Mahuntleth.
Yeah, because that shop sounds like, I mean, maybe her experience of going through kind of the hippie phase and everything, and she went back to romantic Wales and her vision started taking place there, didn't it?
Yes, it was a vision that was a reaction against the hot pants of the 60s, the sort of Mary Quant's trend-setting bazaar. Now, she believed that actually women preferred to cover up. And when she found that she was able to sell these high-collared, lace inset, frilly, pin-tucked sort of clothes, when she discovered that actually these were quite popular, she developed her philosophy as to why they were popular. And she believed they were popular because actually women were sexier the more they covered up, the less they revealed. I never knew if she really believed that, or again made a virtue of necessity. She developed this sort of company mantra that Laura Ashley was the romantic outfit. And she said that women, there were four rules for her dresses. They should be comfortable enough for women to bend down and pick up the toys, comfortable enough to reach up and put the jam away on the Welsh dresser in your kitchen, revealing enough that you could actually breastfeed a child. And then here's the ultimate, that when your husband comes home from work, they should be pretty enough to welcome your husband home. I mean, it's bizarre today, but it somehow tapped into the zeitgeist of the 70s or 80s, that women wanted to be dressed as, you called it the peasant look. Well, it was peasant. I almost think, you know, it was dressing as a country milkmaid almost. Yeah. Because they had so much fabric, they made extra frills and flounces. A lot of the other dresses that you bought were so skimpy they'd fall apart. You know, you'd tear them as you put them on. They were so tight. Laura's clothes had frills and flounces and pin tucks and aprons and petticoats underneath. You know, yards and reams of fabric, because Bernard realised the fabric was very cheap, and once they had the factory to print it all, they could print extra. But, you know, this was a time when women could stay at home looking after their children and be pretty. But I think Laura Ashley was just a child of its time, because can you imagine, once women had to go to work or needed to go to work or wanted to go to work, you can't turn up at Goldman Sachs dressed as a 19th century country milkmaid. I mean, it's ridiculous. How could you be a lawyer or any sort of job? You need to look proficient, efficient. And that's what Laura reacted against. You know, a pinstripe trouser suit would really be anathema for her.
And for Bernard, interestingly enough.
Well,
like you said, you didn't like the suits.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So maybe their vision was together, really.
More about Laura after this.
You can rely on Radio Gorgeous.
Wales, she brought a lot to the economy, which was brilliant, wasn't it? And she got very loyal people working for her.
Yes, I think the move to Wales was absolutely critical because, of course, there was the Welsh Development Agency that was giving them grants, but it wasn't just officials who welcomed them. It was the local Welsh farming population who embraced them. They thought they were a wonderful couple, a bit eccentric or exotic. Bernard said to me, one of the things that was so exotic about them, we eat garlic. And apparently the Welsh thought, you know, they'd never heard of people who ate peculiar things like that. But they were a charismatic couple. And the whole fortune of the Welsh valleys depended on Laura Ashley really doing well. So Laura started by taking work to women in their homes, outworkers. She was big on outworkers because she thought she was really helping women stay at home with the children. She didn't want to take them away from the children. And then she did develop helpful things like letting them go home at 3:30 so they could be with their children, organising buses to collect them. She did lots of things that, you know, now nowadays we call paternalistic, it was maternalistic. Yeah. But she drew the line at certain things. You couldn't get too close. If you overstepped the line, that was no good. But they were very friendly with the local farming community who willed them along to success. Otherwise, there was such rural depopulation. I think it's 3,000 homes didn't have electricity or running water when Bernard and Laura went there. So, of course, this was sort of manna from heaven to have this couple with this terribly successful company. And the farming community was used to irregular hours. You know, the man that they hired as chief pattern cutter was actually the sheep shearer, Marian Rowlands, because he was good at cutting. But, you know, not only was he used to getting up at 5 a.m. if there was a, you know, lambs are born when they're born. You can't tell them to wait till 9 o'clock. And so he would do his bit on the farm and then he'd drive a lorry to London overnight when there was less traffic. He'd do two jobs at once. And they helped Bernard construct the second-hand machinery and build it and put it together. So it was very much a community enterprise.
Now, their first shop in London was in South Kensington, and that used to get, people used to queue at the door. Can you tell me kind of what a sensation that was?
Yes, I remember it. You know, you'd queue and you'd wait to see what the lorry would unload, and you didn't know. I mean, there were queues, that was part of the camaraderie in these communal changing rooms, and they were so cheap, you didn't really need to try them on. You'd just take armsful of stuff and bring them home. And sometimes you'd find that a zip didn't work or the colours didn't match up or they were asymmetric or irregular, and that was part of the charm. Laura sold that. I think later on, she deliberately made these sort of intentional flaws of a pocket on the wrong side or something like that, because that was part of the rustic charm. You thought you were buying a piece of the countryside. It was like delving into your grandmother's dressing up box. It was a sort of theatrical experience. You'd wear a Laura Ashley dress and you'd assume a whole different persona. I remember buying things to go with it, or I was given a cameo to wear at my neck because, you know, that was part of the whole Victorian image, that you were assuming a different personality when you wore a Laura Ashley dress. So they were terribly cheap and you'd come back for more and you'd never get the same thing because they didn't know how to repeat it. Yeah. It was really a whole experience of queuing up at 23 Pelham Street.
Fantastic. So was it luck or was she canny in her instinct for forecasting trends, would you say?
Both. That's a really interesting question. I think she was canny in that she believed most women, her catchphrase was, most women like to live life as nicely as they can. And she was right. I mean, house decorations, the home furnishings were not expensive either. And that was part of the charm, that you could walk into the high street shop and come out with rolls of wallpaper and fabric and, you know, do your house up really cheaply. And previously you had to wait for a catalogue and it was expensive and you'd order it. And, you know, it was just a bigger deal. This was such fun to be cheap and cheerful and nice. And that carried on with the clothes too. I think she recognised that not all women have the figure for hot pants and, you know, revealing big fat legs. So she realised many women were much more comfortable with covering up. Yeah. Because she didn't actually like wearing those clothes herself. Her own wardrobe was, much simpler, navy and white, a bit of a hangover from her Wren uniform.
Yeah, sounds like it.
She really believed that other women wanted to dress up in these pretty, flowery, flouncy clothes, and she did hit the zeitgeist there. But for herself, she preferred something very plain and very simple. And of course, as they had more money, she preferred silk rather than cotton, and things had to be made in China, which was a bit of an embarrassment because she actually had plugged the Made in Wales, which she did believe for a certain time. But some of the fabrics that she got used to, the more expensive fabrics later on, had to be made in or sourced in China.
Let's just talk about the expansion of the shops, because obviously, you know, she had the one in Wales, she had the one in London. How did it suddenly, during the 70s, expand, and how did Bernard and her kind of cope with that, the fast expansion?
Well, they couldn't sit still. Bernard, that's what I discovered by being with him. Bernard brought the excitement to Laura's life. Bernard brought the excitement to the factory. And he just couldn't sit still on anything. And he needed to expand. He couldn't resist. So every market town in England had its Laura Ashley. And then there were people living abroad, often expats, who approached them and said, I'd like to run the Laura Ashley franchise in wherever it was, Spain or France. So they spread very quickly throughout Europe. And then, of course, America. Now, America was a different story because it cost a lot to import into America and there was duty. So the American clothes were much more expensive all along. So they marketed themselves differently as designer clothes. And for a while that worked. But actually, there was no way you could compare a Laura Ashley dress to haute couture. And the prices were very similar. So it was difficult in America. And then, of course, Ralph Lauren came along. And I mean, he was certainly very similar to Laura Ashley. So the Laura Ashley operation in America was always more problematic. But Laura Ashley in Europe was an extraordinary phenomenon. That part of the charm was looking British when you were in Paris.
So they made a fortune, and again, Bernard, you know, risk taker, change. Right, let's go to France, let's become tax exiles. I believe that Laura really didn't like, I mean, for her to leave Wales must have been very hard.
I think it was leaving her family as well. I mean, they didn't speak French, so why on earth would they suddenly enjoy living permanently in France? Of course, it was wonderful to have the chateau. That was exciting, and that developed her design ideas. She had much grander ideas later in life. She developed a Bloomsbury range, the house called Charleston in Sussex, which belonged to Vanessa Bell and all the Bloomsburyites. Laura was involved in recreating some of the fabric that Duncan Grant had developed, and that was really exciting. And she got to know the Duchess of Devonshire at Chatsworth and loved her aristocratic connections there, researching, albeit in the attic of Chatsworth, and developing some of those fabrics to sell at Laura Ashley. And their own castle in France gave her grander ideas too of how wealthier people might want to decorate their houses. But being a tax exile was something she hated, because she hated leaving her family, and her son Nick got married and they couldn't even come to her own son's wedding. So that was very hard for Laura. She actually was quite spiritual. She went on a number of retreats, which I discovered, and I think the retreats were her way of coping with a lifestyle that she never foresaw for herself. It wasn't what she intended, but it just happened like that. Bernard had so much energy. He was always looking for something new, some grand new idea.
Didn't they have a Laura Ashley aeroplane, private jet?
They had planes and boats and lorries and boys' toys. Yes, yeah. All sorts
Amazing.
Of things.
Amazing. Laura, as you say, was very loyal to her family. Her children worked for her. And one of the most important influences was Jane, her daughter, who did the photography And it's been described as semi-realism, and it was the first advertising really to do that. Because they put models not particularly made up, maybe with messy-ish hair. You know, it wasn't glossy, basically. Yes. And it sort of had pictures of a sheep in it or something, you know, which that was very much part of the sell, wasn't it?
Yes. It's very interesting talking about the children and how they encourage the children, because it comes back to your point about Laura Ashley being intuitive. Mm. And she felt that only her children, or possibly her children's friends, could understand what they were doing with Laura Ashley, the company. So they believed, therefore, that because Laura and Bernard hadn't gone to school, they hadn't been educated, that their children didn't need. I mean, obviously, they went to school, not higher education, not university.
You know, you could, Holland Park, didn't
it? Yes, but not university, because actually Bernard believed that too much education knocks the creativity out of you. So they were almost anti-education to an extent. They just believed that it was intuitive. And Bernard was very keen for Jane to be the company photographer. That was something he got her going with. And she did have an instinctive feel for these big, blown-up, black-and-white photographs in the shop. And you'd come in to the shop and you'd immediately get an idea of what you two could look like wearing a Laura Ashley outfit. Now, we're very used to shops showing big pictures of models now, but it was revolutionary at the time. You'd walk into a Laura Ashley shop and see these extraordinary photographs. They were usually models. Not always, actually. Mm. Sometimes they used their friends. And Jane had a real knack for this. So that was part of the selling the lifestyle message that Laura managed to convey. And then, of course, Jane and her mother had a terrible argument because Jane went to do a shoot in the Sahara and she wanted African women with unshaven armpits. And Laura did not think that was part of the Laura Ashley image she wanted to convey. So Laura and Jane often had arguments, but you're right, these were dramatically different photographs used in a very different way, and now it's something we've got used to and we take for granted, but exactly. But it wasn't at the time.
Now, sadly, you didn't meet Laura. Tell me about her. What did you learn about her personality?
Oh, terribly divided and fraught. She really, I think, was... I don't think we've recognised her as a designer adequately. I think that is yet to come. I think
that's because she's a woman?
No, I think perhaps it's because she harked backwards, so she's not considered original. I think she really was original in how she used the past and brought it into the present. Mm. I don't think what she was doing was really what 19th century milkmaids wore. It was her interpretation of it. Yeah. And I think the prints were different because of the ability to print in the way that they used them. So I think we will recognise her design flair, and perhaps that's just starting to come back. But as a woman, she was conflicted because she was really a powerhouse, but she pretended not to be. She always bowed to the superior ability of Bernard. It was an accident that the company was called Laura Ashley. When she was offered an honour from the Queen and it was sent to Laura Ashley, she had to return it because she knew Bernard, who justifiably was her partner, but he couldn't cope with the fact that she was the one who had the honour. So she returned it. But she pretended that she wasn't really working because she made a big thing that although it was okay for women to work, it was not right for mothers to work. She said, oh, I don't really work because Laura Ashley is not a company, it's my family. Because it was called Laura Ashley, she managed to convince herself that actually this was not going outside the home to work. Laura Ashley, the company, was her home. It was, after all, called Laura Ashley. So she would bring her children into the factory or the shops, and that wasn't really work. And so the youngest child, Emma, would crawl along the design floor studio and the designers would help her and give her crayons. And of course, it was a kind of nannying. It was a kind of, you know, what we're all forced to do in order to work. We have to have other people look after our children. She didn't believe she was doing that. Another of her little tricks was that she put the children to bed at 4:30 and told them it was nighttime. And, you know, so she could convince herself that she wasn't actually working while the children were awake. She only worked while the children were asleep. So she pretended that she wasn't really working. You know, she was a feminist ahead of her time because this definitely was her input, definitely was her design influence into the company. She was the one who made sure that things happened. Bernard might have had a million ideas, but she was the one who enacted them, who made sure that the ones that were feasible actually happened. She saw it through. She was a project manager. And yet she had to convince the outside world that she didn't go to board meetings. She didn't do the man's business. But of course, she really did. So I think as a woman, she was conflicted and she found that quite hard to pretend that she took a back seat when, in my view, she very definitely took a front seat.
Do you think that's because she's from just the post-war generation where, you know, stay-at-home mothers, that was a thing? You know, maybe she's a reflection of the cultural, what was happening while she was brought up.
Partly. It was, you're quite right, a world on the cusp of change. But I think it was being married to Bernard, who she loved. And Bernard would not have coped with her being the one who everybody assumed was running the company. And I think she knew that actually she had to bow to his needs.
Now, the kind of peak of Laura Ashley, I suppose, was the end of the 70s. There were over 70 Laura Ashley shops worldwide and businesses booming. You know, this is when we're living in France, they're living the high life, everything. Then in 1985, Laura's daughter had a baby, and obviously she went to Wales to go and visit the baby. It was also her 60th birthday. She was staying in her daughter's house in the middle of the night. Can you tell us what happened?
Yes. This was Laura's first grandchild. And Jane had rented a Cotswold cottage for the birth. Mm. And Laura and Bernard came over, and for some reason she woke in the middle of the night. Now, nobody quite knows why, and the press assumed because it was her birthday she'd been drinking. But Laura wasn't a drinker. I don't believe it was that. I've read the coroner's report. Presumably, she tripped over a nightdress that was too long and fell headlong. But it was a complete tragedy because the company was just in the throes of going public. And it was an open secret that Laura was not in favour of going public. They needed to float the company to raise the money for this extraordinary expansion that did come about very suddenly. They needed money to fund all of this. But Laura knew what an invasion of privacy it would be. So there had been many arguments. So a lot of people assumed that it was a result of the arguments, that Bernard and Laura had had an argument over this. Nobody can prove that. The story that one knows is that she fell, and she fell headlong, and she was in a coma, and she never regained consciousness. So the company had to go ahead with its flotation.
Yeah, but only 6 weeks after her death did it float. Yeah.
Yes, but without the figurehead and without Laura Ashley. Now, I don't believe that even if Laura had remained, the company would be successful today, because I think it was tapping into a particular moment in British history. And I don't believe Laura could have continued with the Welsh workforce, which, of course, was expensive. It would have broken her heart to get rid of people and to close factories.
And they did do that, didn't they?
Which, of course, eventually they had to do. It's now owned by a Malaysian cement company. And you look at the shops in the high street and you think, can I tell the difference between Laura Ashley, Next, Monsoon? Mm-hmm. They don't have their own identity. No. But every time they try to make their own identity, they go back to Laura. They have heritage brands, legacy brands, the Laura A label. They keep trying to recreate Laura's spirit.
Yeah, it'd be fantastic. We were saying that. I mean, if they did more retro dresses, completely like 70s, because that's what people would love.
Yes.
It's like going and buying vintage.
I agree with you. I think that would be terrific. I would love some of those. A bit toned down. I don't want to go around looking like a country milkmaid, but some of them.
Also, I read that when she did very early designs, they were kind of like overalls.
Because they didn't know how to do any better. She didn't know how to sew. They were absolutely front and back the same, scoop neckline. That's all they could do.
But I think that would be very in now. People love that kind of practical chic. So how far-reaching is her legacy, do you think? I mean, who has been influenced by her, do you think?
Oh, who has the sort of British feel? I would have to say Kath Kidston, really. Has picked up the mantle.
She
dressed windows for a while, so I gather.
Yeah,
yes. Orla Keely, perhaps, has the look. something instantly recognisable. You know whose hand is behind it.
You know, but Kath Kidston has had success, but it still isn't as big as Laura's. Laura's was incredibly big.
Worldwide.
So, as you say, she should really be more recognised than you think.
I think she will be. I think when people look back on 20th century design history, can you pick one thing that Mary Quant did? Her hairstyle, most people think about. Well, her hairstyle wasn't hers.
No, that was Vidal's.
Of course, there was a Mary Quant look. Yeah. But it's much easier to define a Laura Ashley look. I mean, you'd go to a wedding in the 70s, everybody was in a Laura Ashley dress with a florally straw boater and white tights. Yeah. I mean, I look back on some photos of me and I cringe. But, you know, we all thought it was so romantic.
Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you very, very much for talking about Laura Ashley today.
It's really my pleasure. I love talking about it.
Totally fascinating.